Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We had to go into our private stash for that cut from the Prince song Raspberry Beret. That's because it isn't easy to find Prince music online. Even last week when social media was flooded with tributes to the music icon who died unexpectedly at the age of 57, the links weren't from YouTube or streaming services such as Spotify. That's exactly how Prince wanted it. Joining us now by phone to discuss copyright protections for creative works and Prince's legacy is intellectual property and entertainment law professor at Drake University, Shantavia Johnson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Anne. Good morning.
You've described Prince as a pioneering advocate when it came to asserting copyright protections. Why so?
Prince was fiercely protective of his music, and as you pointed out earlier, it's almost impossible to find comprehensive works from Prince online, and that was because he felt very strongly that artists were pretty much taken advantage of online, and everywhere he went, he touted this idea that artists should take back control of their works, including how people could receive that work online and offline.
He famously feuded with his record label over the ownership of his music. Can you talk a little bit about what's typical for young musicians, singers, that kind of a thing, when they get a record label and how the label has an advantage?
Oh, definitely. So if you're a new artist and you want to sign with a label, you typically have to enter into a contract. And that contract is more often than not one-sided, in the favor of the record label. So essentially, the artist will sign away any rights he or she might have to her music in exchange for the money, the resources that the record label has. And that's basically what happened with Prince. He was in a position where, in order to continue to disseminate his music the way he wanted, he had to enter into a contract that he felt ultimately was unfair. Even though it seemed like there was a lot of money involved, ultimately, he had to give up control over his work. And because of that, as we saw for almost 30 years, we would see Prince with the word slave written across his face. Mm-hmm. He changed his name to a symbol that nobody could even say. It had no pronunciation. And that was why, because he felt like he was a slave to the record label who owned all of his work. So even though he was out there making music and songs, he didn't actually own any of that stuff.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about intellectual property and the entertainment business. My guest is Shantavia Johnson. She's an intellectual property and entertainment law professor at Drake University in Iowa. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, Shantavia, it's interesting because I remember when Prince wanted to be known as the musician formerly known as Prince?
The artist formerly known as Prince,
of course. At that time, it seemed sort of narcissistic. I mean, the story that was getting out to a lot of people didn't seem to be getting at the heart of the problem.
Right, right. And frankly, that's the way record labels prefer.
Okay.
So in Prince's particular case, of course, he had been prolific since 1978 when his first record came out. And ultimately, what Prince felt was that, you know, he was making all this music, had no control over it, and frankly wasn't making nearly the amount of money that the record label was making off of that work. And this has happened to some of our favorite artists. The Beatles notoriously signed an agreement when they first started making music where they didn't even get royalties. It happened to TLC, Michael Jackson, the best of them. And so this was actually very common, very common. And ultimately, what we see happening now is artists learning from the mistakes made by Prince, Michael Jackson, the Beatles, TLC, and either not going the traditional record label route, or if they do, building followings before they even get to the record label so they have better bargaining power.
When he got ownership of his music back, he was very aggressive in enforcing that ownership. How did that work with a company like YouTube?
So there were significant issues. Prince was notorious for either threatening to sue or suing everybody. He felt like only large corporations and not artists made money from online music sales. So in 2007, with YouTube in particular, he filed a lawsuit against them and actually several other companies. And ultimately, more than 2,000 videos of Prince's or music and videos related to Prince's work were removed from the website. And not only would he sue large companies like the YouTubes of the world, but also fans. And in one particular case, he filed a lawsuit against 22 fans who posted links on Facebook. He ultimately dropped that lawsuit. But he was staunchly opposed to online use that he felt negatively impacted his work.
Gosh, I wonder what he would have thought last week. people were moved to tears by the Purple Rain video from the Super Bowl performance in pouring rain. It was incredible. What would he have said about all of that, do you think?
Well, so a few years ago, he gave an interview where he said that he could not stand digital music because it just didn't sound the same.
Yeah.
And he felt like the art was, you know, whatever the artist created it to be. And digital music, frankly, is not the same thing. I mean, I was in Atlanta last week and my husband took me to a high-end record store and they played real records.
Wow.
And for the first time, I actually heard the difference. And so I think Prince certainly felt a certain way about digital music, though in recent years he changed that position a little. He actually had an exclusive deal with Tidal, which is, of course, the company that Jay-Z purchased and has turned into a more friendly way for artists to stream their music. And the thing that Prince actually liked about Tidal was the fact that they use higher-end audio. So the audio has a better quality than what we get from some of the companies Prince didn't so much care for, like the Spotify's and Pandora's of the world.
He also gets a bigger cut, right? 75% versus 70.
Well, there's certainly a bigger cut. It's not necessarily 75% is a number that's been thrown out there.
Yeah.
But essentially, what artists get from Tidal is more control, they get more access to their fans, and also a better cut is basically double, maybe three times what they would get from Pandora or Spotify. I saw this fascinating graphic just yesterday that outlined that an artist would need to have their music played on YouTube 4.2 million times in order to earn the United States minimum wage of $1,260. 4.2 million is a lot. And just by comparative purposes, Beyonce's Lemonade came out yesterday or whatever day that was.
Yeah, I think it was
yesterday. She posted a video a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And just teasing it, and it got 2.5 million views. So if Beyonce can't get to that 4.2 million, it's going to be really difficult for artists to do the same through a company like YouTube. So Tidal gives them a much better shot at making money.
And Jay-Z did this was this a really conscious effort of Jay-Z's to compete in an ethical and qualitative way with the other online streaming services?
So that's what it seems like. So if you even look at kind of the terms of use on the Tidal website and they explain why they're better for artists, they say, really, we want to compete with record labels who are not paying artists what we think to be fair. And so this is a way for artists to become owners in a new and different way of streaming and have better control of their music.
And, you know, you mentioned what other groups have been doing, too. And you mentioned Macklemore and Ryan Lewis in particular, how they've responded to the challenges that Prince reacted to.
Right. So Prince, or later in his career, suggested to artists to remain independent for as long as they could. And Macklemore and Ryan Lewis were maybe some of the most famous artists who did that. They famously won 4 Grammys a couple of years ago for an album called The Heist, and they did not have traditional record label support. They did kind of use the independent arm of a particular record label, but basically they went that route of staying away from the record label contracts, the contracts where essentially artists sign over all their rights.
Some might have viewed Prince's stance as overly restrictive in a digital age. He might have limited his audience, for example. What's your take on that argument?
So, and I tend to agree that perhaps you do limit yourself. I mean, Tidal has a little less than 3 million subscribers. Spotify and Pandora, YouTube, of course, have a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the artist gets the right to control how they want their work disseminated. And in copyright law, we have this principle where once you create a work and you own it, you get to decide. And if you as the artist decide that you want to limit your work in any way, you have the right to do that under American copyright law.
What about questions of fair use? Because you wrote about how Prince might have, how he started to object, I think, and I'm not sure what he ended up doing to a video of a dance recital that had his music in the background. Did he really mean to affect things like that?
Oh, right. So in the particular case you're talking about, there was a mom with a toddler.
There's always a mom.
Dancing in the
yeah.
kitchen. Right, exactly. And one of Prince's songs was playing in the background. It's a less than 30-second clip. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's barely audible. But Prince found out that this was on YouTube and sent something called a takedown notice to YouTube, essentially saying, hey, this violates my copyright. Please take it down. And that mom's response was, this is something called fair use. And the principle of fair use essentially says that I have a right, even though you own this as a matter of copyright law, fair use is a defense to any claims that I have, what we call infringed your copyright. If the use qualifies as fair use, it's not illegal. And so there are different ways to get to fair use. And frankly, with all the years that we've had fair use, nobody really can say definitively when something is or is not fair, a fair use of someone else's copyright. And fair use really is designed to push back against this very broad right that we give to copyright owners. So in terms of what Prince might say about that, I mean, I think as we've been talking about, he really believed in ownership interest and ownership rights and copyright. But fair use really is the way that, to the extent you can push back, that's the only way to get there.
And how did the Digital Millennium Copyright Act of 1998 affect how artists control their music online?
Oh, so the DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, essentially says in the online universe, if you are an artist, or even if it's me, I mean, say I write poetry and I find my poetry online somewhere mm-hmm. where I haven't approved it, I can send a letter to, like, YouTube, for example, and say, hey, you should take this down. And what that has done is given artists another way, really, without filing a very expensive lawsuit, to control what happens with their work. Now, some of the issues with that are, since we don't really know, we don't have a black letter kind of test to figure out when something is fair use, there's a lot of interpretation there. So there, even though it's helped both the artists and people who are doing things that are fair, it creates a lot of gray area. So there actually have been a lot of lawsuits about how we define this gray area. When is something fair, where a takedown notice to the DMCA is not going to be done, and when is something not fair? So it's helped in a way, but it's also created a lot of other issues.
Well, Shantavia Johnson, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. This has been fascinating.
My guest has been Shantavia Johnson. She's an intellectual property and entertainment law professor at Drake University in Iowa. She's also the author of an article about Prince's online presence and how his views on his private property, his intellectual property, have affected that online presence. If you want to check it out, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When you see something inappropriate or offensive online, on Facebook, for example, you might flag it, and in some cases, it will be removed. Before that happens, a moderator gets involved and makes a decision. How such decisions are made, however, is not necessarily that public. That culture has raised questions about free speech in an age when so much communication occurs on platforms owned by corporations. Joining us now by phone is writer and the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project, Soraya Shamali. She co-wrote a recent article in TheVerge.com about internet moderation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Can you give us a sense of the size and scope of internet moderation at some of the biggest sites? What does it look like?
So some of the larger platforms use a combination of their own in-house staff and call centers and outsourcing. It really runs the gamut. It can run anywhere from hundreds to thousands of people around the world. There are really no industry figures that have been published that studied the scope of the overall staffing for content moderation. But I think it would be fair to say that at companies like Facebook and YouTube, we're in the thousands.
Why are companies secretive about how moderation operates?
So I think there are many reasons. One is they don't want people to game the system, right? They don't want people to understand exactly how it works so that they can then abuse it, which will almost inevitably happen. The second is because a lot of decisions get made that are intensely human, and the secretiveness gives companies flexibility to make those decisions, I think. And also, in many ways, it masks the impact of brand management on those processes, right? Like, what does the moderation actually say about the image we have of these companies? And how much do people really want to know about the impact of that kind of marketing emphasis? And it's questionable.
I think it's interesting because we spend so much time, you know, on my show and many other places talking about algorithms nowadays. And this is such a distinctly human role in these companies.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think people generally believe that this is a very automated process, and it's really not. There are increasingly automated aspects of it, and there are technologies being used to identify content, to sort content, to screen content. But what really is quite evident is that it's humans making human judgments and decisions, setting the rules. You know, even if it were algorithmic, we would still be talking about the fact that someone has to define what goes into algorithms, and that gets to the heart of subjectivity and objectivity and norms and the way cultures are created.
You know, I report every time a scantily clad woman tries to friend me on Facebook. Of course, I don't friend them back. But, you know, that's just scratching. That's just the very tip of the iceberg when we're talking about stuff. And you interviewed, I'm not sure if she's a former moderator or not, but she was one of the first people with YouTube, I believe, and one of their first teams that did this back in the early 2000s. And it's pretty horrific what they go through. It's a very emotional experience.
Well, I think that nobody really understood what was happening as it was happening, right? And so you had small teams of people. Very often it's startups, which is still the case today. Startups, I think, really underestimate what is required in this area. But small teams of people that never really had any specific training, certainly not in the dynamics of secondary trauma, which is what happens to many people. They are really seeing the worst that the world has to offer. And the person that you're referring to is Julie Mora Blanco, who was extremely open with her story, for which we're very grateful. But yes, I mean, they see horrible violence, horrible abuse, incredible depictions of hatred and dehumanizing activities, and nobody talks to them about what this means and how it works.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the internet and who moderates what goes on the internet, especially social media. My guest is Soraya Shamali. She's a writer and the director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. She's written recently about this for Verge.com. We'll have a link to her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Soraya Shamali, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And if it's decent, you can post it on Facebook. Go to our Facebook page and do that. So ultimately, these decisions are made by humans. They are subjective, and context can be a tricky thing. Cultural differences are a big deal. The protests in Iran a few summers ago brought that into view. Can you talk about what happened?
So, you know, these are companies that are based in Silicon Valley, and their customers, certainly the large platforms like YouTube and Facebook and Twitter, are overwhelmingly in other parts of the world. And so there are very frequent instances daily, because we're talking about millions and millions and millions of reports, of cultural differences that manifest themselves. And so one of the issues with what happened last year had to do with what constitutes newsworthiness. The image, I think, the example that you're referring to has to do with the death of a protester during a protest, and it was very graphically violent, which violates rules about depictions of graphic violence. And then the question becomes, well, what constitutes newsworthiness? Which isn't so much, I think, a matter in this instance of who would agree on what was graphically violent, because it was very clearly graphically violent, but perhaps when. So there was another example that we gave in which a moderator spoke very clearly to the fact that some graphic violence counted as newsworthy, but graphic violence in other parts of the world didn't count as newsworthy. And as a moderator, he was enraged because there was no seeming rationale for why, you know, murders in Mexico were not counted as newsworthy, but deaths in Iran were.
Yeah, he said something like, these are all different kinds of wars is all.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he really touched on this question of who's making this decision about newsworthiness. What are the value judgments that go into those decisions? And, you know, we know that algorithmically there's bias built into the system, although that seems to also be challenging for some people. But you know, when you really stop and consider that this is millions of items of content that are being evaluated every day by people who are trying their hardest in very difficult circumstances sometimes. You know, this is not implied that this is an easy job done lightly,
mm-hmm.
But these are human beings, and they are making value judgments, and they're making value judgments about free speech globally.
So do the different, what do we know about to the extent to which, say, Facebook or YouTube or Pinterest or any of them have guidebooks, have created sort of like you know, guidebooks on what they do, and how do people use those?
So all of them have guidelines, internal guidelines, of varying levels and degrees of detail. No company would share their internal documents with us.
For the reasons you mentioned before.
Right. And Catherine Bunny, my partner, and I, we've been doing this for several years together now, writing about this topic. And so there have been occasional leaks about what those guidelines look like, but there really has been no transparency for all of the reasons we discussed. But, you know, I think what they strive for is this idea that there's some measure of objectivity. If it looks like X, then do Y. And some of the companies like Pinterest seem to share a lot more of that with users. Pinterest gives examples, photographic examples. This is okay, this is not okay. And that kind of is meant to help users understand the guidelines a little bit better. But a lot of companies don't do that at all. You know, their guidelines are pretty basic. And I think probably one of the more disturbing things at this stage is that every new company that starts starts from scratch, right? They have to do this. They have to make this up on their own. And they tend overwhelmingly to reproduce the same errors and to respond and to invest only after there's been something quite ugly or catalytic that's happened, often in the public eye.
You referred to an October 2014 Wired story by Adrian Chen that looked at the work of frontline moderators operating, as you wrote it, in modern-day sweatshops. Who gets hired to do this? What kind of people are they hiring? Are they journalists? Are they anything special?
So I think it depends on where you're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, some companies will say everybody we hire has a college degree. Other companies won't say at all. Some of this work, as Adrian Chen wrote about, is really outsourced to people who really just are making a pittance, and they're working on this kind of incredibly psychologically and emotionally taxing content with very little support. What's happened at a company like Facebook, though, is that they're now hiring in expert areas. They develop expertise in-house, people who only work on suicide, people who have experience working with rape victims. And so people are developing those areas of expertise. They also have hired, as we wrote about in the piece, consultants who are there really to walk through the process of how to manage this content, how to help employees. And a lot of the companies that are doing this, though, it's a voluntary step that people have to take. And I'm not sure that really does the trick. I think that for this kind of work, it should be a requirement of the job. I mean, we've just talked to so many people who don't realize they're being traumatized as they go through the process, which is often the case with secondary trauma.
You wrote that many of your sources describe moderation departments as sealed off from the rest of the organization. What do you know about why that is?
So I think there are a couple of things. One is that nobody wants to see really awful ugliness, right? I mean, at one point, we talked to someone who was sitting in a large open workspace, and their screen was visible, and nobody actually wants to see what they're seeing, right? So if it's terrible depictions of child abuse, or graphic depictions of rape, you know, to see those things sort of pop up on a screen in the middle of your workplace is very jarring. It's jarring for the people doing the work. It's very jarring for the people who aren't doing the work. So I think that by necessity and by default, this work was increasingly sequestered. The other thing, too, though, is that I think that traditional corporate structures are siloed, right? So you have engineering in one place, marketing in another place, customer service in another place. And those structures are just bent and reproduced in corporate structures. And so I think it's a combination of those things.
Can you compare the moderation policies of, say, Facebook and Reddit and how those policies affect content differently?
So, yes, that's a huge question. There's so many policies, right?
And yeah.
So all of these companies, I know you were talking about copyright before, all of these companies are, you know, they follow the letter of the law. And so copyright pretty uniformly is respected because it becomes a legal issue and a liability issue. But after that, you look at content, for example, non-consensual photography, right? I belong to a large working group, a coalition that worked for years to have these corporations have guidelines that would allow someone who was the target of non-consensual pornography to request that it come down. And some companies do that, and some companies weren't doing it. Now they're pretty uniformly doing that and removing those by the terms of their own guidelines. But what's remarkable is how different these cultures respond to that question. So Reddit, for example, was much more dedicated to the idea that they were not going to become involved in policing content at all. And I think that has cost them in terms of growth. Mm-hmm. And I think that they, like Twitter, have come to the conclusion that, you know, the levels of harassment and of abuse really are unsustainable and undermine their principles of free speech. I think that was a really hard thing for some people to come to terms with, the idea that these platforms were not neutral and objective, and that for many people, being able to exercise free speech required a different kind of framework and response and understanding of how their speech was being suppressed by the threat of real violence.
Pinterest is known as an industry leader in content moderation. What are they doing right?
You know, that's so interesting. Catherine and I talked a lot about this. I think it's interesting the degree to which these platforms are gendered. Hmm. So Reddit is thought of, you know, Pinterest is thought of as a kind of woman's space, right? And we don't really think of Reddit as a man's space in the same way, because it kind of gets passed along as just a space where people go. But it's overwhelmingly men on that platform. And on Pinterest, it's many, many more women. Mm-hmm. And I think that those cultures reflect both the audience dynamic and needs, but also reflect the staffing. So if you look at the composition of staff and you look at the value of the labor, I would argue that there may be a lot of different things going on in these two cultures. Pinterest seems to be much more alert to what exactly their audience, made up mainly of women, might need in terms of communication, privacy, security, and understanding their guidelines. Whereas Reddit, I think for a long time, they were responding to a very vocal part of their community, which basically said, we just want to do and say what we want, and this is what free speech means to us. And in the last couple of years, I think you'll see that Reddit has come forward and said, you know, these are problems for us. But at the same time, last year, Reddit lost 4 senior women within a period of a few months. And so I think that tying together the lack of diversity in this industry with the tolerance for online harassment is really essential to understanding how cultures develop responses to the problem.
What do you see the future of moderation looking like? I guess I initially think, when I'm reading about this and talking to you, why isn't there sort of an industry standard out there? Why don't they make it easier on each other, have some kind? But they don't want to even do that.
So I think what's interesting is that the people who've been doing this the longest talked to us and said, you know, we are independently getting together and working on those issues. And it's not, you know, I think the corporations are probably kind of circling each other talking about these things.
Uh-huh.
And there are places like the Berkman Center that for years have suggested some standards. But, you know, the fact is it's kind of organic. And there's also what I can only describe as this global cottage industry of organizations, civil society organizations, that have grown up out of necessity. And they push back against these companies. They work closely with them sometimes. They are in opposition with them sometimes. But they're doing a lot of this work, which is frankly unpaid,
mm-hmm.
As people defining this public commons. And so I think the future for it to be meaningful needs to be really multidisciplinary. It needs to involve more transparency on the part of these companies, more engagement with civil society, more understanding of the data that we have, because we don't have a very good understanding of data. There isn't a lot of accessibility to the data for academic study. And it's a new academic area of study. So, you know, I think we're going into this phase now with 10 or 15 years of people saying, oh, okay, this is what we're dealing with now. The kind of open society standards that we thought were best are not working so well. But that, I think that does beg the question, who is doing this and should they be doing it? I mean, people don't really think of it as censorship unless we're talking about China, right? Mm-hmm. But what we're really talking about
or government
are corporations,
in general. Yeah.
Or government in general. But, you know, these corporations really function across borders of kind of proto-governments, right? I mean, they've got billions and billions of quote-unquote citizens who think their content is not being regulated, but is really being regulated.
Soraya Chamali, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you for having me today.
Soraya Chamali is a writer and director of the Women's Media Center Speech Project. She co-wrote an article about moderation of the internet and how it's shaping the future of free speech. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Smartphones, we use them for email, banking, documenting our lives with photo and video. That's why it's so important to keep access to that information secure behind a lock screen. One solution to make that easier is the fingerprint scanner, and there's new evidence that it is working. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor to AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So Google just released its Android Security 2015 Year in Review, and it had some interesting numbers about fingerprint sensors. What did they find?
Yeah, so the biggest thing here is that, you know, over the last year, we saw a whole bunch of different phones that are running Android come out with fingerprint sensors. And so this was the first time that you know, Android as a whole was able to kind of be monitored to see how people were using different things. And the biggest bit of information to come through was a 43% increase in the use of things like Android Device Manager and you know, kind of general security things, but also a significant increase in fingerprint sensor uses as a method of locking the phone instead of having nothing at all.
And was there any correlation to improvement in security or less breach of security, I guess?
That is a lot harder to measure because it kind of has to be done on a case-by-case basis. But Okay. Yes, you know, for the most part, you know, there's a whole lot of things that Google does, you know, to keep the phone secure as people are installing new apps and trying new things. And so those things are always being done and changed to improve. But the idea of using a fingerprint lock screen, you know, just because it is quick and easy, you know, instead of using nothing at all is just going to be better. Even if you're just stopping someone from picking up your phone and using your Facebook account without your permission.
So what's the weakness of a numerical or pattern code to lock your phone?
So numerical and pattern code locks are not weak by nature. They're just, you know, something that someone can maybe look over your shoulder and see as you go to enter in. Or if you have a brand new phone, then you may notice the fingerprint on the screen, you know, in the trace pattern that you have left the phone in. So it can be easy to kind of socially engineer that password away in order to gain access to the phone. Whereas the fingerprint, you know, you have to have someone physically there in order to unlock it.
How many phones in the smartphone market have the fingerprint capability now?
There are hundreds of them around the world, but really the big ones over the last year came from, you know, Samsung and LG and of course Apple, with a noted increase for Google themselves when they released their Nexus phones this past year. With the Nexus 6P and Nexus 5X, they were also running these fingerprint scanners on the back, and a big part of that has to do with Google making fingerprint scanner technology, you know, like a core part of the operating system, where it's not just used to unlock the phone. You can use it to authenticate payments if you know, use your phone to make payments, or to replace a password if you're doing things like making purchases or something like that.
Are there any concerns about using fingerprints? You can change your password, but you can't change your finger, although I've watched too many sci-fi movies now. Someone could rip my finger off, my finger skin off my finger.
There's absolutely a real concern, you know, going beyond, you know, a worst case scenario. You know, like you said, you can't change your fingerprint, and there's been some discussion, you know, kind of on a countrywide level about whether law enforcement officers can use your fingerprints, you know, with or without your permission to access your phone. You know, so there's some concern there, but it's, you know, from a basic security standpoint, the position largely, at least from my opinion, is that it's better than nothing, and really the goal for a lot of people, we're talking about the same group of people who will use the word password as their password, or, you know, 1234 is the pin to unlock their phone. So this is, you know, notably better than that, even though it's not, you know, the best form of security that you could have on your phone.
Do you talk to people who look far into the future, you know, eye scans and all that kind of stuff, breath, biomarkers?
We have seen companies over the past year show off demonstrations of what they're calling eye prints, where it's using, you know, a retinal scan of sorts to unlock. Basically, it's using the camera on the front of the phone to you know, kind of match up with your eyeball and use that to unlock the phone. And some really fascinating technology about how it kind of is accurate enough to see the blood vessels in your eyes to make sure that it's not just a picture and things like that. But it's one of those things that gets really hard to use in the real world when, you know, you step outside and it's really sunny and all of a sudden your camera doesn't work so good because it's direct sunlight and things like that. So it's hard to get to a point where it's ready to be used, you know, everywhere. Mm-hmm. But it is something that companies are thinking about.
In Apple news, there's an updated laptop. The new MacBooks have several updates in performance and a new color. What's the deal with them?
Apple make a laptop to match their iPads and iPhones. And so they have a rose gold or just really bright metallic pink, if you're not a big fan of code names, MacBook. This is the super, super thin MacBook that got released last year, where it's not running a whole lot of hardware underneath, and it's just this incredibly thin computer that's not overly powerful, but it is, just this really portable machine. And so this is an upgrade, across the entire line to, add more RAM, add more storage, and add a more capable processor so that these machines, the big problem with them last year was that they were really pretty and incredibly thin, but really limited as far as what they were capable of doing compared to other MacBooks. And this update brings them a lot closer to what current, MacBook Airs and things like that are capable of.
So it's not just about looks and weight that's actually capable of doing a lot more now.
Yes, this is going to be significantly more capable. And it's really hard to have a machine like this be as capable as it is. The whole idea is for this machine to be no moving parts. You know, even the trackpad, doesn't push down when you go to push in on it. It uses a special, kind of haptic feedback system to give you a vibration that feels like a click when you push in. And so there's a lot of really fascinating technology that went into this line of MacBooks that kind of pushed Apple forward when it came to these laptops. But it was definitely underpowered for someone who is used to, using a MacBook for things like video editing or running multiple programs at the same time or something like that.
What does it compare to for people who can't afford Apple's price point yet?
Dell has a computer that is pretty capable, that's around the same price point. It's not quite as thin. It's part of their higher end Dell line. And that's the thing, is that the things that this compare to are really close to the same price point. Hmm. So for people who aren't able to afford, the kind of Apple price increase, you're really not getting the same experience if you're looking for something that is thin and portable without paying within $100 or $200 of what Apple is currently charging for these.
Do you remain surprised at the popularity of the rose gold?
I don't. I honestly think that I wish that more of our technology here in the U.S. came in colors, really any color. We've seen, you walk into any electronic store and everything is, kind of flat slabs of gray and silver. Mm-hmm. and things like that. And it's always kind of bothered me a little bit. I love, having a little bit of color to my technology. And it's something that it's fascinating to see how it picks up in other parts of the world. But here in the U.S., we just don't get a lot of color when it comes to our tech. So it's cool to see, Apple kind of taking this slow move forward with this rose gold. It's also fascinating to see that it is not gender specific.
Yeah,
the rose gold gets picked up by just about everyone. And that is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, things are changing a little bit. Very slowly. Virtual reality is here. You have a new review of the HTC. Is it Vive?
It is.
Okay. I'm getting this now. You begin your article with the sentence, "Three zombies are staggering towards me. Tell us more about this gaming experience. What was it like?"
It is fascinating. The whole idea of virtual reality is that it takes you from, where you are to another place where you can kind of look around and see in a 360-degree view an entirely different place. And What we have seen so far has been, you know, you've got a controller in your hand, so it still feels very much like a traditional video game system where you, you know, push the controller forward in order to move forward, and you press a button in order to, you know, open a door or fire a weapon or something like
or
that.
Or run away fast.
Or run away very fast. HTC has worked with Valve, who has been working in the PC gaming space for years now, to create a virtual reality system where instead of having, you know, a controller in your hand that's like an Xbox controller or a PlayStation controller, you have these wands, and you are moving around in the real world. So I'm taking a step forward in the real world, and my character is taking a step forward in the video game. And when I pick up my arm and you know, extend my arm, the flashlight that is in that arm in the game reaches out in the exact same way with the exact same movements. And so when I see those zombies in front of me that I have now seen with my flashlight, I can choose to, you know, stand my ground, or I can choose to get out of the way.
Your article is titled 24 Hours in the HTC Vive. Were you really in the headset for 24 hours straight?
I was in the headset for 24 hours total. I was not in the headset for 24 hours straight.
Okay.
Despite my intentions, it turns out that I am married to someone who really refused to let that happen. So,
Well, total of 24 hours, what do you mean? Like one night you stayed up all night and another day you, what do you mean?
It was over a 2-day period. I was in it for 18 hours one day and then finished up the rest of the second day. And it was really just exploring, you know, how comfortable this thing is to be worn over time and what all of these experiences are like that HTC is and Valve are providing and how this is different from sitting on your couch and playing games on your Xbox. You know, it's all of these different things kind of coming together.
What is it like to have something like that on you for 18 hours, though?
It is not comfortable after a while.
Yeah.
Because it's a big piece of plastic. They've worked really hard to balance the weight out with these straps that go across your head. So it's not like resting on your nose like some of the old virtual reality things are. So that was really nice. An HTC system is actually designed to work really well with people with prescription lenses where the glasses actually fit into the headset and you don't have to really work around or worry about damaging your glasses. And so for me, that was a really big deal, you know, being able to still feel comfortable and not have to worry about stress on my eyes as much.
Uh-huh.
But really it's, you know, standing or sitting or moving around, it's a whole lot of work to make you feel like you are actually standing and doing things in the games that you're doing, whatever it is that you're planning on doing it, where you're you know, underwater looking up at whales as they're swimming by, or there's this really amazing solar system expansion where you can look at the entire solar system and kind of pick up planets and look at them and do kind of fascinating things. And it's something that I've even shared with my kids for a little while, you know, where they can go and paint in a three-dimensional space where they are walking around the actual canvas and you know, adding things in space instead of, you know, on paper or something like that. It's an entirely new way to kind of create things, and that was really cool to watch.
Can that be preserved?
It can, yeah. I have a whole bunch of those pictures right now.
That's pretty cool. How diverse of a selection is there for downloads? What is the universe sort of limited right now?
So it's interesting what they've got set up right now because, you know, they've been doing this for a little while where they've had developer kits out for companies to work on this virtual reality space for a little bit. But the selection of games are very new. They aren't it's not, you know, a catalog that someone who's played a lot of games on an Xbox would go, OK, I recognize those titles. Those are games that I know that I will like. There are a whole lot of new experiences. And while that's great to see new developers doing new things, it's also a little on the intimidating side for people who aren't sure, you know, that $40 or $50 game is going to be worth it because they don't really have anything to compare it to. So it's an interesting situation they have right now.
Well, Russell Holly, thanks as always for the information. We appreciate your time today, as usual.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor to AndroidCentral.com. That's it for Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.